acknowledging the traditional owners of the country, and to thank Aunty Di. She's not here anymore, but someone could pass on the message of thanks to her for her very warm welcome to country today. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I think Ian's points about building our networks and collaborating is quite important, particularly at this moment of history where so many of us are Indigenous people are getting our PhDs. You know, after all of this time, we're enrolling and we're moving on and trying to build this evidence base around the work that we do. I think we've still got a bit of a way to go. Certainly, speaking for myself, I've still got a bit of a way to go, but they're exciting times. And Kathy, would you like to
go on?
Okay. I thought I'd just start talking about our work through this particular quote that I saw in The Good Weekend. I'd had a bit of time off with my young daughter was born, and I got back to work and happened to be flicking through The Good Weekend and noticed this quote, and it was in my face again that, you know, this is the space that we work in. Young student had obviously done a couple of Indigenous studies subjects as part of her pre-service teaching degree, and she said that, you know, it's a question I'm sadly too scared to raise in my lectures for fear of reprimand or worse. So we know that a lot of the students come into mandatory Indigenous studies with a range of preconceptions, and they're not all negative, but there is a whole spectrum. So we've got a lot of students who come in and they say, well, the subject's going to be quite easy. And we get a lot of students saying, I did a lot in primary school, you know, as if that's, you know, as much they're very experienced because they did it in primary school. It's going to be quite depressing. The students say, you know, there's no good stories. You know, we learn a lot in history, and it was all kind of the history wars. It was a negative kind of narrative. It's going to be humourless, you know, poor fella me, I'm going to hear a lot of sad stories. And the previous I'm back in the 80s. The previous slide showed that it's going to be a form of indoctrination. It's going to be something that is going to be endured for the whole semester. And also this idea that why do we need to know this stuff? I'm not going to be teaching any Aboriginal students, so it's not going to be relevant. I've never met an Aboriginal person. You know, I don't know much. We've actually had this as a comment coming out of a focus group. I live in the Shire, which is a very sort of Anglo area. You know, what's this got to do with me? But then you'll get the students who say, you know, I'm quite indifferent. I just need to pass this subject. And you get that kind of passive, aggressive feeling coming through in tutorials. But then you get the students who want to save the world. They're looking forward to the subject and they want to make a difference. So we know that it's the mandatory Indigenous studies space is a contested space where students will exhibit open and latent hostility, and perhaps the latent hostility is the one that we're really trying to address here. We've had instances in our teaching because mandatory Aboriginal studies at the University of Sydney has been there for 20 odd years, but it's only just been introduced into the secondary program as a consequence of the New South Wales Institute of Professional Teachers, the academic standards, the professional standards, I should say. So for the secondary course, it's only been running for 2 years, 2-3 years. You get a lot of negativity, shock and surprise. Preemptive defensiveness is something that came out in one of an interview from a tutor who said that she could feel that the students were less forgiving of any errors that were made, that she had to sort of go out of her way to be twice as more organised, you know. There's also a feeling of ambivalence and indifference, and some students romanticise the curriculum. There's also that comes along with this, often a missionary-like zeal of passionate anticipation, but also the genuine enthusiasm and interest. And the students who identify with the personal experiences, you know, they're not an Aboriginal person in the class, but they may feel that they identify as the issues coming from particularly a disadvantaged background. So one of the things that we've tried to do in our research is think about the different voices that come to the curriculum space. So we're looking here to think about the learning environment, that when we come into the lectures and the tutorials, what kind of voices do we need to engage in this space to create a culturally safe learning environment? And at times those voices will compete. So the Indigenous standpoint is one that we put up as a priority in the work that we do. And this picks up on the issue of removing Indigenous perspectives, Indigenous knowledges from the margins into the centre of learning. So we look at Philip's quote here to give us a guide to Indigenous standpoint pedagogy, which aims to release and targets existing resistance that I've mentioned already, and the inclusion of Indigenous perspectives in decolonising education contexts. So when we're talking about decolonising the curriculum, we're really talking about looking back into the colonial space, and we're trying to reveal those historical relationships that have been set up, and then challenge those and create a space for Indigenous autonomy. So then we look at, we've been looking at the other voices that come in, of both the Indigenous and non-Indigenous lecturers and tutors, because one of the things that we are doing in this space is reinforcing to students that it is a relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples that, in that learning space. We need to, in that space, interrogate whiteness, the normalisation of whiteness, take a critical approach to the work that we do. And we see that the classroom can be a space as a battleground, but we're moving this to say, well, it shouldn't need to be, we shouldn't need to have the cultural wars in our classroom. It should be a shared history approach, and the students are, we've received a lot of feedback that suggests that this shared approach that Paddy Kavanagh, one of our lecturers, takes has been quite helpful in getting the students to think through how we should look at history. We're also trying to interrogate Aboriginal culture as deficit, moving on to a strength-based approach there. We're also looking at the voices of non-Aboriginal students. One of the things that we're finding, and the students are reinforcing this through the research that we're doing, is that silence is the enemy of transformation in our classrooms. If we don't have students talking about the issues, if we don't have a safe space at the beginning of the semester, and the first few classes hold quite a degree of gravitas, actually, for opening up that space, and it can be quite difficult to, if you don't create that comfortable space, to transform that learning environment into a positive one. And also thinking about the voices of Aboriginal students, they're a minority in mandatory Indigenous studies units, you know, and often we've found, looking at the stats, that some of those students haven't identified themselves in that space. So that we may, it was interesting looking at some of the stats, we've figured, for example, last year in the primary program that there are only two Aboriginal students, but when we looked at the statistics there were around six. So why is it that those students aren't talking and discussing, you know, and that it may not be a safe space for them. So it's thinking about all those different perspectives. So our research question that Kathy and our research that Kathy and I have been doing to try and deal with this great diversity of preconceptions in the work that we're engaged in, we've come up with three questions that we've focused our energies. And the first one was, what extent does the implementation of pedagogical content knowledge what extent does the implementation of pedagogical content knowledge enhance student learning? And pedagogical content knowledge is just a very fancy way of saying how does the intersection of content and pedagogy transform knowledge in the learning environment? So many years ago, I know my colleague Leah Louie and I wrote a paper talking about content getting in the way, that we were so concerned about the content that we were going, you know, and the reading material that we're going to use in this particular unit of study, and we weren't focusing on the pedagogy. So it does sound quite common sense in actual fact, but actually doing this in a practical sense can be quite challenging, particularly for new staff that we're bringing on. How do you make this curriculum live and practical for the students? And then the other aspect was, how do we create and model a culturally safe learning environment, which I just mentioned is absolutely paramount to the work that we're doing, that we have to engage everyone in that safe space. And then finally, and related to Christine's forum here, is the, how does the assessment processes, did they capture the aspects of the learning that we are hoping that take place? So we started to collect data in 2010. Actually, I should probably start here. And what we've been doing is conducting focus groups at the end of each semester in both the primary and secondary degrees. So we have a combined degree program, which includes science, history, mathematics,
drama, English.
Yeah. And we also have a human movement degree. So in all, we've conducted 38 focus groups in the second last or last week of semester. And on the right-hand side there, you'll see we've also taken some end-of-semester, unit-of-study evaluations, and we've got the response rates for those. But today, what we're going to do is give you a bit of a sense of the focus group data and our findings from that. We haven't really had time to go through and look at the qualitative data, the demographic surveys, and the end-of-study evaluations. So when we started out, we positioned the work that we do under the broad headings of, you know, Aboriginal education is core business, dialogic inquiry is essential to create this culturally safe learning environment that we're talking about, and dialogic inquiry is really about collaboration, creating communities of practice. And the notion of critical and border pedagogies, we keep sort of shifting back and forth in our focus. And we've picked up on this idea from Phillips's PhD that resistance should be seen as a pedagogical tool rather than something that we overcome. Okay. So this is to do, I guess, with the idea that dissonance, a bit of discomfort is required for that transformation to take place. So that's, I guess, the context of the work that we're doing. And Kathy's going to talk about the assessment processes now.
Okay, so in line what we've been doing in terms of a bit of research on the program, getting some feedback from the surveys that Katrina mentioned are standard surveys that all courses use, you know, so they go to a whole range of courses and we always do ours. You don't have to do them all the time, but we do them fairly regularly because we think the feedback helps what we do. So the changes we've made to assessment have been based on student feedback and probably largely from the focus groups, I'd say. So we're looking at secondary ed at the moment, but initially we had, we always do a tutorial presentation and they always do it in pairs, but largely because of the time factor. We only have, you know, 2 hours a week for tutes. We only have 11. I think we lose a week for a public holiday or, you know, the usual things that happen. So we have them do that in pairs. And we did, for a couple of years, we did where they had to put an actual perspective to their subject area. And that was really interesting and that worked well, although the maths and science people always, or particularly the maths people always find feel a little bit disadvantaged because it's a little bit more of a stretch, I suppose. Although I have to say, some of them came up with some amazing stuff using Aboriginal art and geometry and tessellations and stuff like that. So it actually was really good for them because it stepped them right, particularly for students in that kind of pedagogy of what maths is like. It made them get right outside of that and think more laterally about how they might approach it. We do a critical analysis and evaluation of teaching resources, and we used to provide the resources, and we did that because it was a bit more manageable in the task, and we used to provide them with a range of resources that they could choose that were, you know, reasonably good resources, and then we had another range that were poor resources and they had to sort of evaluate and compare those. And then we had a research essay, so where we tried to get them to link theory to practice. So there'd be the first part of the question would be around the theory and the second part would be something about how might this impact on you as a classroom teacher or what measures might you take in a school context or whatever to address these issues. This year we changed it slightly. We decided to move the tutorial presentations to address some of the key issues around the contemporary debates that come up each week in the lectures. We only have, like I said, about 11 weeks, so it's really hard. It's like, you know, Education 101, you're sort of trying to get everything in and jam it all into, because you know they're probably not going to get it, do it again. So, yeah, so it's about trying to pick out the best things, the things at the end of the essentialised curriculum, I suppose. What do you really want them to know before they get out there in the classroom? One of the reasons we moved to the designing or the going to the key issues is that there was always a reasonable percentage of the students who didn't really engage with the lectures or the readings. We didn't have if you don't have it as an assessment task, they won't do it for some of those students. It's very difficult to assess if you've read the readings, you know, like we've looked, haven't we? We've teased that out a million ways. And so what we decided to do was to each week they'd pull them out of a hat and then a group would address the issues. If the lecture had been on race and racism, well, the two groups who worked that week, we would do some questions, sort of building on what had happened in the lecture. And in that we always build a peer teaching type of activity. So they have to address the issue and then they have to engage their peers in some kind of interactive activity, discussion, something like that. And this year we introduced these peer feedback sheets. They're not accessible, but what we wanted the students to do is get into the habit of assessing each other and looking. And so we had five criteria and they had to pick one that they thought the workshop did well and one they thought that they could improve on and then write a little comment. And they've actually been good, and the feedback from my tutorial is they actually quite enjoy doing that. Because it's anonymous and because it's not assessed, they feel quite free to write things. And then after we give them back their, when we give them back their results and their feedback from myself, I also include the student feedback just for their own development and reflection as a teacher. We've continued the critical analysis and evaluation of teaching resources because probably out of all the assessment we've done, that's the one where they come back and say, wow, that's something we've never had to do before, and it really actually makes us think because it makes them dig into issues like the hidden curriculum and covert racism and all those kinds of things. So it really, they start to see a practical application to many of the concepts that we're trying to talk about in the lectures. And we give them we do a little, in the tute groups, we do a little thing on critical literacy and we take some resources in there for them to have a practice with evaluating and start looking at the language and deconstructing some of the language and stuff in the text. So they actually really enjoy that. But a lot of them felt that providing the resources and us saying this is appropriate and that's not constrain them a bit, because the cleverer ones tended to find bad things in the good resources and good things in the bad resources. So we opened it up a little bit this time and said, well, you can choose the resource you want. Is it after 2004, I think?
And not rabbit-proof fence.
And not rabbit-proof fence, because they all say they've seen it seven times in high school, which is a fairly big indictment on our system, I must say. But they have to provide us with not only the reference, but the few pages or, you know, whatever, something concrete. So as we're marking it, we're not trying to find the resource, so it's kind of there for us. And we moved to a more of a scenario-based research essay. So we'd give them a bit of a scenario about maybe a school context, and then they would have to draw out the issues and then think about ways they might address them. So we haven't... That's the first year. We're doing that this year. But the feedback in the tute groups has been they like the scenarios and they're quite looking forward to doing them. And then after that, we've got the public holiday next week, the tute group after, my group will sit down and we'll start, I'll put them in groups and get them to start, you know, brainstorming the scenarios and, you know, get some ideas down before they have to actually write it. So we do try and, in tute groups, do try and sort of help them a bit with the assignments or give them opportunities to discuss them amongst each other and with us so that they don't, because Aboriginal education, I find, is an area where they have no idea. You know, most subjects they go in with some idea. All the ideas they have is, you know, how are we going to do 12 weeks of throwing boomerangs? That's just going to be boring because that's what they did in primary school, or dot paintings or whatever. So we have opportunities to do that. Sorry? Yeah, it's true. It's true. Tragic but true. Okay, so some of the feedback we got from the tutorial presentations. Firstly, just to contextualise, the primary course is only a 4 credit point course, so they only have a 1 hour lecture and 1 hour tute group a week, whereas the secondary is 6, so we get the 2 hours, which is much better. The 1 hour a week is almost impossible to do anything, because even with one presentation, by the time that's done, you have to keep it short. So they often get anxious and they're trying to show you everything they know, engage their peers, and do really well in 20 minutes, you know. So for them, it's a lot of pressure too. So we try and guide them a bit with that. The negative feedback we get is mainly around structural issues. So what we do, we start those in about week 4 and they go through to the end. So those ones who are up first feel quite, well, we're the first ones. But we talk amongst ourselves as tutors that, you know, we acknowledge that they're early in the piece, and we sort of mark them a little bit leniently in those first couple of tute things and give lots of feedback for the rest of the group so that we can say, oh, you spent too long on this, or maybe you could have thought of doing this, so that the groups after have a bit more feedback on to build theirs as well. Please don't take offence. But they felt like they were just resting on their laurels a little bit, and they were just kind of doing a clinical procedure of presentations. And I think, well, they've mentioned there they thought the questions weren't quite challenging enough. And that's another thing we debate with, because, you know, we don't know what the students come to the course with. Some students do come to the course with having been at a high school that's done great stuff in there. They do compulsory issues in year... it's called Rights and Freedoms, which they do in Year 9 and 10 in history. And that's probably the only compulsory stuff that they have. There used to be a compulsory section in Year 7 and 8, Contact and Colonisation, and it was also on comparative with Indigenous people here and overseas. And, of course, in the national curriculum, they've taken that out and made it an option. And, of course, it's number 10, in option of 10, of course. So we have been writing to ministers with no success on that. So now there's only that little bit. But what we find that we don't know what they come with. By and large, though, and one of our groups a couple of years ago did this as a research project for another one of their subjects. They looked at students' experiences of Aboriginal education or Aboriginal history or whatever prior to coming to university. And they found a very high percent had very negative experiences in learning about Aboriginal history or learning anything about Aboriginal people. And it was very ad hoc. And it really depended on how the teacher taught it. Man, it's actually quite sad. I've been a secondary teacher for a long time before I came to university, and it's quite quite sad that it's, because it can be taught so interestingly, that it's really being taught quite clinically and out of the textbook, and the kids just get bored with it. Mind you, you 9 and 10 kids, you're lucky if they're breathing at the end of the day anyway. It's not a stand up. Yep, we're still here. A couple more minutes to go. But, so it's not necessarily easy to engage them anyway. But, it's quite sad. We've been doing some discussions of that around our Aboriginal Studies Association, which is for secondary or primary and secondary teachers. The positives is that they felt that it focused on the practical application to teaching. So the good thing for us is that often in universities, in teacher education, the students will go, this is really interesting, but it has nothing to do with what we teach in the classroom, or that's not going to help us teach kids. And we find that we get quite a few saying, no, this will help us, and it actually helps us, because we talk about the student. See, particularly in secondary, most of the subjects, it's all about the discipline. You're a history teacher, you're a drama teacher, you're a maths teacher. So it's about the discipline and the methodology of teaching those areas. We focus on the student. If you don't have a good relationship with the student, you can be the best physics teacher in the world, but if you're boring, the kids are going to learn nothing. You know, you've got to develop that relationship with the students, and by proxy, the families and the communities, if you want to have an impact on their learning. So I think we're one of the few courses that sort of try to address it, particularly in the secondary area, that way. And the ones who get that start to see the flow over into other areas. So the critical analysis, the resource, by and large, like I said, we get pretty good feedback for that. So they get that kind of sense that they're finding out stuff. They're actually able to apply. They listen to the race and racism lecture, and some of them are a bit, it's us and them again, it's this and that. And then we do this, and they start to see a kind of a more practical and day-to-day operation of how that works. And so then you can see the little light bulbs going, oh yeah, like when I first read this, it was okay. But then I looked close and I thought, no, that's not really a very good word to use here. Or Aboriginal people seem to be, Paddy does a really good thing in his history lectures where he shows how Aboriginal people have slowly disappeared from the landscape of different paintings or books. He uses an example of a book where Aboriginal people are front and centre, and as it goes through the years, they slow until in the end you just see the tail of a kangaroo sort of disappearing off the page, and that's the closest you're going to get to any Indigenous culture. So he does a really good job, and they start to pick up these messages, and I think, it starts to get them thinking, at least. We try and just sort of plug into that. And like the second one there, it's one of the better assessments I've had in education, and again, because of the practical side of it. And the other, like I said, the brighter students actually saw some negative stuff in the good resources, and some of them actually write about how you can take a poor resource and actually use it to teach kids to think critically. So, and that's, we've had a couple like that, and they're really interesting. So that it's good that we're getting them to think to that point, that we could actually take this resource that on the surface looks pretty bad, but if we show that to kids and then get them to pick the stuff out like we're doing and model the same sort of processes, they'll start to see through the language and start to realise how things are written and the narratives that have been sort of used over the years. And the last one, the poor maths student was completely lost. I'm not sure what you say to that. But because they have very much, there tends to be, and I'm not all of them, but there tends to be that mindset that sort of, we're just doing the maths, and they often, I guess it is a bit more a stretch for most of them to see the relevance. So we talk a lot about the pedagogy of teaching. So numeracy issues are big for Aboriginal students. We do have poor numeracy rates, and in fact over the last 5 or so years they've started to focus more on strategies for numeracy. The literacy is improving, but the numeracy is still lagging. And so there's been a lot of stuff around pedagogy, not just content, but the pedagogy of including kids, of ways that you might teach kids to turn them onto maths. And it is a real problem. So we try and focus a little bit on that.
I think, Cathy, too, the resource evaluation is problematic for some of the subjects like maths, because so much of the texts have been written from historical basis. So,
yes.
We need a lot more texts out there written from other disciplines.
Yeah, and that's all they've had exposure to as well. That's one of the problems. And they've often not been engaged in high school in those kind of humanities-based subject areas. So the scenario-based research essay is new this year, and that's just an example of the feedback that we got. And we thought, well, we'll try that, and it'll be interesting this year to see when we do the focus groups to see if that's going to make a difference, because an essay is an essay, and they go, oh, they, the only thing they're glad is we don't give them an exam. So that's a thumbs up. But yeah, but we still need that essay to sort of to get them to show us that they've engaged with the literature to some degree, and that they can apply it to particular scenarios, and also to some of the concepts we've tried to reinforce throughout the program. It's a bit vanilla. That's an interesting sort of, I thought that was quite a good way of describing what they thought of the essay. And then it's interesting that I thought we picked this out because it's interesting when a student says they learn something from an essay, because you don't really expect that, because I often go, oh, essay, yeah, where's the formula, you know, intro, main body, four paragraphs, conclusion, yeah. So it's good that, yeah, some of them actually find, because we try and do the essays in a way that we've given them a certain amount of information, but now we want them to reflect on it and analyse it, and then and apply their own kind of interpretation of how that might influence their context of teaching. You can do this one.
So one of the things that we've tried to do to bring an evidence base to looking at our teaching practice is take on board Brookfield's lenses. I think it's quite helpful to look at the different perspectives. And the theoretical lens has been quite important. There's a lot of things that you do in teaching and learning that is tacit knowledge that, you know, is developed over time. But one of the issues, I guess, for us in growing up new, younger academics is to actually name that practice, the nuances of what we're doing. So the theoretical lens has been quite important. The student lens, looking at our focus group data and the end of semester evaluations from a very student-centred perspective, has been important. And the other aspect is looking at the peer lens, so developing a community of practice, a collegial support network, where we can share our ideas and having those critical conversations about what is or isn't working in our teaching has been quite important. So the self lens is also quite important, looking at our autobiographies as learners, and interviewing staff, getting anecdotes. I mean, we often talk about coming back and debriefing after some of the sessions where there has been a lot of negativity or perhaps racism manifest in the tutorial. So recording that and thinking about how to work through that has been quite an important process. And one of our tutors agreed to be interviewed. She was the person who I mentioned at the beginning, saying that there was a bit of latent nastiness within the group. You know, the students were less forgiving. It's quite a good quote. I think there was a bit of nastiness there in that sense that I'm going to pick the eyes out of whatever things happen, when really anybody with goodwill would not pick up on that. And I certainly didn't get it from any of the other tutes. But as I said, I feel I should have actually analysed the group a lot better and worked on that. Yeah, I feel I should have. So it was really that interview gave us I guess the impetus to keep talking about those experiences, because what was happening with this tutor is that she was going away and being quite upset, you know, getting home and crying all the way on the train on the way home, because it was such a bad environment to be teaching in. So what we're doing now is making sure that we are supporting each other every couple of weeks to preempt that.